Hello and welcome to the latest Bruin podcast. Today we're looking at US value investing with Dodge & Cox, a very highly regarded investment firm based in San Francisco. We're going to be looking at financials and industrial sector, but we'll have a slightly more extended conversation on healthcare, looking at how it works, some of the political risks, but most importantly, where the best investment opportunities lie. But before you listen to that discussion, please listen first to our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Bruin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Bruin podcast. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Head of Fund Research, and today we're going to be looking at US equities, in particular the value part of the market. Delighted to welcome our expert guest, Diana Strandberg, on the investment team over at Dodge & Cox. Diana, how are you?
I'm great, Ben, and thanks for having me today.
Well, we're delighted to host you. And we're delighted you've flown in all the way from San Francisco just to do this this podcast. We're really pleased. Now, in terms of content, I think in the limited time we have, we'll first look at value investing and the case for it at this juncture, and then we'll dig a little deeper into some areas that I know you're a bit more keen on, such as healthcare and financials. And within that healthcare space, I think, you know, it is a pretty politically charged topic at the moment, so perhaps we can touch on the politics. So let's begin with value investing. Clearly doesn't seem to have quite delivered the numbers that some of the more sort of growthy parts of the market, that the fast-moving tech has delivered. But why don't you sort of lay out the case and the appeal of value investing this time?
Sure thing. So if I can just take a step back, at Dodge & Cox, we think of ourselves as part owners of individual companies. So we have a very long horizon. And we think valuation is a very important part of investment returns. So you'll hear me speak a lot about starting point mattering to the outcome. And so that's really the crux of things when you think about value investing. Right now, it's been under pressure, really, 7 out of the past 10 years, it's underperformed the growth part of the market. A dollar invested in value 10 years ago would be about $3 today. A dollar invested in growth would be about $4 today. So you've seen that difference in performance.
And that's about how much I invested 10 years ago, actually. So I'm pleased with my winnings. Anyway, carry
exactly.
on.
So what's happening today is the starting point is quite provocative in that, because of the underperformance, if you will, and because this is really wrapped up in the value index, so to speak, or value investing is largely in the less expensive parts of the market are financials, energy, industrials companies, and the growth parts of the market are largely technology, consumer staples, parts of the market. So the value growth debate also is kind of wrapped up in whether interest rates will remain low or go higher, whether economic growth is slowing or accelerating, whether companies have volatility relative to the market or stability relative to the market. And we think that the global financial crisis has largely really reset people's views about those topics. However, we're starting at a point where the value benchmark, if you will, altogether is about 12 and a half times forward earnings. So absolutely cheap and cheap relative to the market. And the growth part of the market is almost 20 times earnings. And the differential between the two is about as wide as it's ever been in the past 30, 50 years, depending on the period you want to measure. There have only been three periods in the past 100 years where you have seen value underperform growth for such an extended period of time: the Great Depression, notably, the tech bubble, and today. So understandably, we're getting a lot of questions around, is value still relevant? And we would argue absolutely. As I mentioned, we think starting point matters a lot to long-term investment return. And we think looking at individual companies, so now let's dive under the hood. We talked about financials being a big part of the value cohort, if you will. When we're out looking at different financial services companies, and our investment team, our research team, has deep knowledge about these businesses. We have a very stable team. Analysts start their careers out of grad school at Dodge & Cox, and they spend their careers at Dodge & Cox. So knowledge of financial services, you know, of 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 30 years ago, is still walking the halls and involved in these discussions. So we believe we have a lot of intellectual capital we've built up around these businesses. And what do we see today? We see a group of companies that we own in the portfolio ranging from about 7-8 times earnings, maybe 12-13 times earnings, that have vastly more resilience in terms of their funding model and their balance sheet strength. They are returning significant amounts of capital. So if I looked at the dividend and share repurchase yield of these investments, it's about 9-16%, depending on what company we're talking about.
So they can pay that out without putting more strain on their balance sheet?
Yes, because they have to go through these regulatory stress tests. The regulator won't allow them to return capital. They have to submit capital return plans and have them approved after these very stringent stress tests. So we think that that's more durable than the valuation suggests it is. And this is all about what's already priced in. Investors, we think, are highly concerned that low interest rates will impede the earnings power of these companies for the foreseeable future, that regulatory pressures will remain, there's an expression we talk about in the United States, foot on throat of these companies. And when we go in, so this is kind of what we'd call the signal versus the noise. To us, the signal is this very low valuation, and then having this deep fundamental knowledge of the individual business that suggests the earnings power is strong and the balance sheets are far more resilient than is priced in. And so we think that this is a really compelling area, and it's roughly a quarter of the U.S. stock fund portfolio today.
Well, I mean, we could have, but we won't have a big macro debate about why rates could stay a little lower for a little longer. But the point you're making, you continue to stress, is sort of that sort of priced in. And there's some optionality, if you like, should. And indeed, it's relative to expectations, isn't it? The market's expecting interest rate cuts. So if they don't get as many as they're expecting, then interest rates can move higher. And
that's, you know, right. And even through this period, let's consider that interest rates have fallen really for the past 10 years. Or they're certainly lower than they were 10, 12 years ago.
I'd say so, yeah.
If you disaggregate the return of the financial services companies into valuation, earnings, and capital return, earnings have grown, capital return has grown, valuations have compressed. And so, again, you know, we think there's an advantage to really looking at the individual business, the facts at hand. And what's interesting to us is if you look at the sensitivities of earnings power, credit quality is much more important to the earnings power of these businesses than rates are.
And the credit quality.
It's not that rates are unimportant. I don't want to leave anyone with a sense that if rates rise, it won't be good, or if rates continue to fall, it won't create some headwind. But credit quality, their underwriting standards are far more important to their long-term business.
And that's a good news story.
We think so.
Okay, well, let's come back to financials. Let's move to healthcare. And Obviously, it's very interesting to us Brits about how healthcare sort of is structured in the US. But rather than sort of discussing the whole sort of complicated suite, I'd be interested to know which businesses or which parts of that sort of healthcare supply chain service you invest in and where they fit in terms of the consumer's sort of healthcare experience, and then sort of why you think they're sort of decent investments.
Okay. So our healthcare system might seem extremely...
Wrong? No.
I was going to say wonky to someone that's used to a, you know, national healthcare service model. We do have the largest and most complex healthcare system in the world. It's a little over $3 trillion of spending, and it's about 17% of GDP. So you can see why there's been so much focus, and it's typically grown faster than GDP, the spending. So you can see why there's so much focus on this. Just to put it in rough terms, it's about roughly half and half government, private payer. And in terms of our investments through the chain, we own both the pharmaceutical and a few biotech companies. So what we'd call the innovators or the curers of what might ail somebody. We own some of the insurers and benefits managers, so the healthcare services companies, companies like United Health or Cigna, for example.
And what is it they do? Sorry, they are...
So United Health is both insurance and what we'd call healthcare management. So they can help try to manage costs down for the payers.
Right, okay.
And provide then coverage to the individuals.
Sure.
And then pharmacy benefit managers then negotiate savings on behalf of the plans or the payers.
Yeah.
And then we also have CVS in the portfolio, which is really on the pharmacy side of things.
All right, well, that makes, I think
and
I'm on top of
pharmacy. You were about to say that makes sense, and U.S. healthcare makes no sense. Okay.
So why are these investments appealing to you?
So we always have to start with valuation, because starting point matters. If we're looking at some of the healthcare services companies, for example, you are looking at very low valuations relative to their history and relative to the market, somewhat around... if you're talking about Cigna or CVS, for example, 7 to 9 times forward earnings. For companies that we think are part of the solution, by the way, if you think about the headlines are around, you know, we need to have a single payer for healthcare. And when you poll, most Americans say, we think that's actually now a good idea. And then when you ask two more questions, you say, okay, and then... we need to raise taxes to pay for it because it is not inexpensive to do this. And by the way, the private payers subsidize the government system.
Yeah.
So that would go away. So there would need to be much more funding, if you will, than currently in the government system. Americans, understandably, anyone understandably says, well, I'd like it, but I surely don't want to pay for it.
Yeah.
And then if you say, and remember starting point matters here too, if you then say, by the way, what are you willing to give up that you currently have in terms of what you're entitled to, in terms of the drugs you might be able to have on your insurance or the services or the doctors, people say, oh, no, I'm not willing. And that's where the popularity declines quite dramatically. And so... we think that the focus is largely going to be on the roughly 30 million of Americans that remain uninsured. By the way, half of those could be insured under the current plans and aren't for some reason, by the way.
Okay.
But why do we own some of these healthcare services? So I started with valuation, and the reason I was going into the framing is they are part of the solution of helping improve outcomes and lowering cost. In fact, the government itself outsources to the services providers some of the Medicaid and Medicare program to administer in terms of the database and the knowledge of patient outcomes. these companies have vast knowledge and resources that they can bring to bear on helping to understand what treatments are more effective, what interventions might be more effective. And particularly as medicine moves increasingly away from lots of pills, lots of cheaper pills, if we're talking about generics, to more specialized medicine, so personalized medicine, treatment of chronic illness. Think about immuno-oncology or diabetes as examples of that, where you really need not only the treatments, but a whole array of managed services around that for patient outcomes. This is where these companies can play a pivotal role.
Well, I'm sure they can play a pivotal role, but are they being sort of caught in the crosshairs of market fears about drug pricing, or are they, or other political issues that are sort of weighing on valuations, perhaps unfairly, or are there sort of arms of their business that actually could come under genuine political pressure that on their own margins?
So yes to all of the questions you just asked, but again, let's disaggregate. The headlines we think are far worse than what reality is likely to look like. Why? Because you're out there in front of potential voters and you say the headline, and then it's up to your policymakers to actually write legislation. And that's where the real, you need, that devil is definitely in those details. And we spend time in Washington talking to policymakers so that we can better understand how they're thinking about issues, what's feasible, so that we can better assess what parts of their businesses might be under risk right now. So certainly there is more scrutiny over transparency for the pharmacy benefit manager model of wanting to put more of the rebate, if you will, in the hands of the consumer. What's interesting is that's likely actually to improve pricing for the pharma companies, not erode it, even though it's improving what, putting more of the savings directly in the patient's hands relative to the insurer's or the payer's hands. But we think that what the market is, so they're responding to the headlines, and you've seen these stocks come under tremendous pressure. But the rhetoric is far worse than the reality when we look at, again, these companies in terms of being part of the solution to lower costs. And the government itself, if I gave you a statistic, I think about 30% of Medicare lives, 75% of Medicaid lives are outsourced to private plans. So that is their business.
Yeah, sure. We've sort of touched on financials, and we've spoken a bit about healthcare. So perhaps unannounced, the time we have left, why don't we talk about some other things that are happening in the portfolio? I know you're sort of looking at industrials at the moment, and of course we're seeing at a headline level some of the data look a little wobbly. I think if we look at, let's say, US manufacturing, ISM, PMI, it does show a deceleration of growth. And to what extent would you suggest that look weighs on the potential for the industrial parts of the US stock markets?
So it is weighing. Trade concerns also are a big element, and we appear to be having trade issues with China and Mexico and many in Europe as well.
Yeah.
I'm hard pressed to.
Japan's on the radar as well, isn't it? Yeah.
So that certainly is weighing on these companies as this part of the market as well. So that's the headline. And so you've seen stock prices come in, valuations come in, reflecting these concerns around earnings power. So we always start with what's potentially already priced in. And by the way, when we're looking at any investment, we want to be thinking out 3 to 5 years and saying, what could really go wrong here? What are the risks here? Because there's risk with everything you decide to do and frankly decide not to do. There's a risk. What could really go right, and what do we think is a reasonable central case here to give us a sense of the sensitivities, to help us frame risk-reward, so that we're better able, we believe, to answer the question what might already be priced in. So the other element of this is that our industrials positioning is heterogeneous, as frankly as the market's industrials.
Yeah.
We have companies like Johnson Controls, which we believe are largely a self-help story of cost cutting and really putting that business on a front foot, if you will, and right-sizing the business to move forward with attractive growth prospects. For example, a company like Federal Express, which is right, you know, the trade questions are absolutely weighing on that stock. So we're seeing very attractive valuations reflecting these big macro concerns. And when we go in and look at the individual companies, what we're seeing, let's take FedEx as an example, is a company with a free cash flow yield of around 9-10%, a very low valuation, with a management that has responded to these concerns with proactive cost cutting. They buy back shares when the stock price is low, and they have, we think, an unparalleled global franchise. So we think a strong franchise, proactive management, exceptionally attractive valuation. Now, you know, you're raising through these three things that we often look like we're leaning into areas of investor disagreement. We do that because we have the individual analysts, the stability of the team, that deep knowledge. We look at an array of risk and reward, and we bring that into team decision making. And the reason we think that's so powerful is that's where experience and judgment are at the table, debate the risk reward. And we think that collective view then expands our view of what the potential could be and helps us remain persistent with those convictions. So FedEx, for example, came into our decision-making and discussion, so advocacy by the analyst in this debate, several times over the past 9 months, for example. We will also bring and try to challenge our thinking. So we'll bring in an analyst formally as a devil's advocate. Prove where we might be wrong. Lay out the case. Let's debate that. We'll ask our fixed income colleagues to come in and give us their insights on the macro picture. Are we appropriately baking in interest rates or the economic picture as we're thinking about risk reward? And by the way, for companies that are under a lot of pressure, they are essential to helping us understand, do they have access to liquidity? And you know, do they have the staying power to weather the storm? That's, we think, a really powerful ability then for us to remain persistent.
Well, I know there's much more going on in the portfolio, not least energy. And what other areas? You like industrials, you like financials.
We've been adding to energy, we like financials.
Okay.
And we do, by the way, have meaningful holdings in the technology area of the portfolio. We're just away from largely what have come to be known as the very expensive, large, you know, the FANG stocks.
Yeah.
We're largely away from that. They're great businesses. We just think the valuations don't make them great investments.
Okay, but you do have some of the
We own Alphabet, we own Microsoft.
Well, next time you come on, Diana, we'll talk a bit more about how those investments are progressing. But we're out of time. We've covered a lot of ground there. I think the case you sort of laid out for value investing at this stage is something that we need to pay very close attention to. But as I said, thanks very much for your time, for coming over to speak to us. A really interesting conversation. And have a safe journey back to San Francisco. To our listeners, let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing hashtag Brewing Podcast, or leave a review on iTunes or SoundCloud, whatever medium you listen to us through. But until next time, many thanks for listening.
Thank you.